You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network. Attention all theater lovers! This Sunday, April 21st, Broadway Podcast Network is holding the first ever Broadway Podfest, a full day of podcast recordings with some of your favorite Broadway stars, live from the Museum of Broadway, which is right in the heart of Times Square. The day begins at 11 a.m. Eastern and features a full day of programming that you don't want to miss. Visit bpn.fm/podfest to get all the details and register to attend for free. That's bpn.fm/podfest.
The NBA playoffs are here, and with FanDuel, your group chat's about to be going off. Because right now, new customers can bet $5 and get $150 in bonus bets if you win. And with live bets, your heart emojis will really be racing from tip-off to the final buzzer. Plus, when you win, you'll get paid faster than your friends can send you a victory gif. Or is it gif? Who cares? You won! So get the word out to your crew and download FanDuel today. New customers bet $5 to get $150 in bonus bets if you win. Make every moment more with FanDuel, America's number one sportsbook. Official partner of the NBA.
21 plus and present in Ohio. First online real money wager only. $10 first deposit required. Bonus issued is non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire 7 days after receipt. See full terms at FanDuel.com/sportsbook. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Gold Bond sabe que tu piel cambia constantemente, como despertar sintiéndola hidratada y terminar con la piel seca después de caminar en un día frío. O tener una piel opaca en el trabajo a lucir una piel radiante en una cita en la noche. Las personas no tienen solo una piel, tienen pieles. Y las fórmulas clínicamente probadas de las lociones Gold Bond cuentan con 7 humectantes nutritivos y 3 vitaminas para ayudarte a cuidarlas. Para todas tus pieles Gold Bond, visita goldbond.com para más información.
Welcome back to my conversation with Adam Feldman. I'm Tanya Pinkins on You Can't Say That. And we're going to go in a little deeper on U.S. politics, Canadian politics, and Carolina change. What'd you think of Parasite?
Still haven't seen it.
Okay. But do you like the South Korean storytelling? Because they do some storytelling that is
I hear Parasite,
way out
I
there.
Hear Parasite was great. I had my best Oscar prognostication year ever this year. I got like 23 categories right. 22. And you know,
and you knew Parasite was going to win even well, yeah, though you'd never seen it.
I think I did well because I hadn't seen almost any of the movies. That's
so
the
you
truth.
You just went for the movies
I
that were being talked about.
I was feeling out the buzz. I was feeling out the buzz and I was putting myself into the perspective of the generic Oscar mood.
Mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
And when you see the actual things, then it's ruined because you have your own opinions on them. You
mm-hmm.
know, you think, oh, but that was so good. That should win.
Mm-hmm.
That's not how it works.
Parasite was so good. It should win.
Yeah, that's what I've heard.
It anyway, wasn't in, nothing else was even in its
league. I see too much theater, and so I've been falling behind on movies a little bit. I tend to see them later on when they come to TV.
And it's spring now, and you're going into theater hell season.
Yeah.
I was a Tony voter for 3 years, and it made me hate theater. I was never so happy as when I was done with that.
It's insane. Well, we're recording this in early March. I will spend the next 7 weeks seeing six shows a week. The sheep's sick.
Well, you should see eight since eight are done a week.
Right. I mean, at least six a week. And by
okay.
the end of that, I will be seeing as many as eight. I'll be seeing matinees on weekends. Sometimes they have, you know, and then cabaret shows and late night shows. I will be very tired at the end because they cram 40% of the Broadway season into the last 6 weeks.
Right. Exactly.
And, I understand why they do that, but it is not ideal.
And when you're seeing that, then you're missing all this amazing off and off-Broadway stuff that's being done.
Right, because the off-Broadway seasons are also in the middle of their best
right.
times. And so I will end up seeing those because I vote for awards and things like that. I won't review them, but I'll see them. Those are among the shows that I'll be seeing. But it's too much. It's too much. And it's an effort, you know, if you see that much theater, it's an effort to remember. First of all, it's an effort to stay open and stay enthusiastic about it and hold on to the magic that got you into it in the first place. But also to remember that most people don't see nearly that much theater. If you're only writing for theater obsessives who are going to see everything anyway, then it doesn't matter.
Right.
You have to be writing in part for real people. and real people see a show maybe, if they like theater a lot, they see a show maybe every couple months.
Right.
And if they're an ordinary person, they'd see one every few years, you know, or they visit New York and they see one Broadway show and they want it to...
And they want it to be Lion King.
Yeah. And why wouldn't... I mean, Lion King is a gorgeous show.
Yeah.
And Lion King holds up really well. Just, oh my God. I had the craziest experience at the Lion King.
Really? Yeah. What was it?
Well, I mean, I saw the Lion King when it opened and I was just, you know, I was blown away.
Really?
Yeah.
I was not.
I was.
Okay.
I absolutely was. I mean, it's a weird compromise show because you have half of it that's just this Disney, you know...
extravaganza
theme park show with the people right. dressed in big character costumes, and then you have this other half that's just mind-blowingly beautiful, and so it's always been a weird mix of that, but I think it really delivers the goods. I think if you want a big Broadway spectacle that elevates itself beyond just a Broadway spectacle,
you don't think it destroys one of the greatest stories in the world?
No,
it's Hamlet.
It borrows from Hamlet, but it's not doing Hamlet.
Oh, it's Hamlet for me. And I was like, how did you take Hamlet
like
and turn
Hamlet
it into this?
It's like half Henry IV. Like, it's a bunch of, you know, it's like, it's the Prince's Journey. It's a lot of different things. But it's, I don't love the story of the movie that much. Maybe that's why I don't mind that it's changed so much in the stage version. I think that ultimately, if you take it seriously, it's basically this kind of divine right of kings, very conservative, you know, with your weird queer uncle interrupting
that,
the
that was not
going to
be my cup of tea.
No. So, I mean, that's not 100% for me. But I think that the staging of it is just breathtaking.
It's very beautiful.
Breathtaking.
I also, anyway, though, as an artist, I take umbrage with anybody who directs things where actors' careers get destroyed. Yeah, I can't like that. I can't like anything that the artistry is not considering the artists who have to do it.
That's fair. But anyway, I went back to see it for the first time in 20 years or whatever.
Ooh.
You know, I went back to see it for their 20th anniversary.
And did it hold up?
It did. I mean, it looks great. Although it was just an amazing experience because it was this huge reunion anniversary.
Oh, they brought people back.
Yeah, there were no civilians in the audience. Everyone in the audience was an industry person or mostly an alum of one of the international
productions.
That
sounds amazing.
So it was like 1,800, whatever it is. So, you know, 1,800 people, 1,700 people, however many people fit in Minskoff. And everyone was there. Elton John was there. He did an encore. He's like, it was crazy. But it was partly crazy because, first of all, there were no children in the audience, right? It was all...
They'd all grown up.
It was all adults. It was all adults. And it was all adults who knew the show extremely well. And they were all just screaming the whole time. So, so Circle of Life, you couldn't hear a word. Oh, sorry, like they could have been singing. I know some of it is not in English, but they could have, the entire thing could have been that she could have just been singing a total nonsense, and it wouldn't have mattered because you could not hear a word. Because everyone, as soon as like the cheetahs would come out, like everyone who had played a cheetah, like, that's my track, and then like it was extraordinary. But it was deafening.
Yeah.
But it was exciting. Mm-hmm. It was, you know, it was one of those rare moments. I had been at the record-breaking performance that Phantom had when it took over from Cats as the longest-running show
yes.
of all time. And that was nice. You know, that was an elegant, lovely, you know, a cat came out at the end, gave a rose to the Phantom, and it was, you know, it was very decorous. But it wasn't this kind of excitement and madness.
See, you get to have experiences that very few people ever get to have, getting
That's
to attend
true.
Things like, do you write about that, or is it just you get the privilege of attending?
In those cases, I did write about the Phantom one, which did not... I don't think the Phantom people liked very much, because I have mixed feelings about Phantom. But I'm glad that it existed. I mean,
Phantom was one of those ones that's like, I'll never see another British show again.
No, I mean, it's just, I'm glad it exists. Lord knows it's given a lot of people a lot of work and made a lot of people a lot of money, and people want to see it. God bless, you know. It's not really my kind of show.
Mine either.
I like Lion King more. I'm like, I can see Lion King over and over, and I will still gasp at the stagecraft in at least four or five of the sequences,
yeah.
you know, and that makes it a night that I will.
No,
I'm
it's beautiful.
Yeah.
It is beautiful.
And, you know, I don't know. There's some shows. I mean, jaded as I am, when I like a show, I will throw myself into it. I saw Caroline so many times. I saw Hamilton so many times.
I've seen Hamilton 13 times. Have I beat you?
Yes. But I've seen it 4 or 5 times, and okay. I've listened to the cast album. You know, I saw Natasha Pierre in the Great Conversation.
I love
12,
that as like well.
Five.
We have similar times. Tastes. We just can't agree on the Lion King, but we have. Yes. So well, wait a minute. Time out. Yeah. You're writing for a specific audience. It's definitely not the audience that is the New York Times, correct?
Well, it's related to that audience. I don't think it's entirely different. It's. What's nice about writing for Time Out is that Time Out has a brief, and Time Out is for people who are looking to find things to do in the city and who are actively engaged in the process of finding that stuff. They want to see the best stuff. They want to be in on the coolest new thing, and that's a good audience to be writing for. If you're writing for the Daily News, then people might flip through your review on their way to the sports pages, and
correct.
That's great, but it's not as motivated.
Right, they're coming to you
they're
to go,
to
tell
us.
Me what's hot.
Right. And I think that's one reason why the Daily News and the Post sort of dropped their full-time theater critics at a certain point, because they weren't really destinations for that. Mm. The Daily News now, Chris Jones, who's from the Chicago Tribune, is now writing reviews for the Daily News, and that's great. And the Post for big shows will have, you know, one of their entertainment reporters write about it, but they don't have a devoted slot for it anymore. We do because we are, to some extent, a destination
for that.
And
it's internationally, so there's Time Out in many places.
Right,
so.
But the theater is extremely local, obviously. Although Broadway theater commands a huge tourist audience.
But there's Time Out London.
But, oh, no, right. But they're writing about London theater. You know,
right,
it's
right,
not
right.
Like,
right, but I'm saying you know Time Out from London. You know when you come to New York,
right.
You go to Time Out. That's your source for what do I see?
Right, it has been. And we've been here for 20 plus years, and we have a certain reputation, I think, that we've been able to maintain for guiding people to the right thing. I'm not being compensated by Time Out for this particular plug, nor by the Tourist Board of Montreal. But yeah, it's a privilege to write for that audience, because you know that people are paying attention. It's a smaller audience than some other audiences, but it's a motivated audience. You know, mm-hmm. We have the people who read it care about seeing good theater.
And so I always wonder, like, for me, I have a kind of rule, you know, silly rules, but it's like, if it's a Time's Out critics pick, I'm not going.
Time Out critics
pick? Not yours, New York Times critics
oh,
pick.
Oh, New York Times critics
New York Times
thank
critics
you.
Pick.
I was like, oh,
I'm not going.
That's a
no, no, no,
mean
not
thing
yours.
To say to my
oh,
face.
No, no, no. No, New York Times critics pick, I just go, like, they bought that.
No, I don't think that's true.
It feels that way to me.
You know, I think they're doing the best they can. I don't always agree with the Times, and sometimes I disagree. It's frustrating because the Times does have more of a voice, a more powerful voice than everyone else. It is especially frustrating for me when a show that I really like doesn't get the...
That they can destroy it.
I don't know if they can destroy it, but they can hurt it, and especially for certain kinds of shows. The kinds of shows, not every show needs critical support, but some shows can really benefit from it. And... what we were talking about with Caroline before is the case. Sometimes you need confidence of going in as an audience member saying, I heard this is good. I'm going to give it an extra bit of trust. And critics can help with that. And so what frustrates me is when a show that I think is really good gets a kind of dismissive review. And Caroline was a good example of that. I mean, not to get back to it, but Caroline wasn't a negative review. It was just kind of a, well, I guess this is good review. You know, like I remember there was a phrase that stuck in my craw from Ben's review, which was he said it was it might be too good to be good. And I thought, well, boy, that's a luxury. Oh, this caviar is too delicious. I don't want it. Take this caviar away. So,
but we were also were the year of the Republican National Convention. We were on the Do Not See list.
Right.
So, you know, it had a lot of
things. And it was
the
year of Wicked
it.
And Avenue Q and Boy from Oz. And so there was a lot of other buzz for other shows. And
right, that were going to make big money,
right.
Believed. And they did make big money. I mean, Wicked is the biggest moneymaker for Universal, I think, of all of its products.
Right. But there was, you know, it, unfortunately, they're...
But that it lost music to Avenue Q. that we're like, come on.
I love Avenue Q.
I love Avenue Q, but that score of Caroline.
Caroline is a better score, but I do love the score for Avenue Q. I will not.
I love it
I'm
too,
gonna,
but yeah. Janine is an amazing composer.
It is, and the again, well, I mean, I don't have to.
You
say
can't
it.
Get that as a revival for the score, right? She can't ever get that.
No,
one.
She can't. But she got one for Fun Home, so.
Oh, so she only gets one?
No, but
I mean,
you know,
I think
comes
that
around.
Stephen Sondheim you know guy it, has a whole bunch of
yeah,
them.
Yeah, Sondheim has a few. but you know, sometimes it comes around. People get things for the wrong thing, and then they make it up later.
I know.
And, you know, it's yeah. silly. But you know, Bernadette Peters won for Annie Get Your Gun, which no one particularly liked her in. And then she didn't get it for Gypsy because she'd just gotten it for Annie Got Your Gun. You know, it's like it's just one of those things.
It is politics. You know? It is politics. And all the awards groups are the same people.
Yeah. It's not even like politics makes it sound like it's calculating. It's fondness, it's industry, it's they've put in their time, it's their turn.
Well, I felt that it was Cheetah's turn for you know, the one that she just did. Was it the one that she just did on Broadway and she didn't get it?
Whose turn?
Cheetah Rivera. I thought it was Cheetah's time. And
oh,
she
for the
didn't
visit.
Get
no, but she already had. She already had.
I thought she didn't have a Tony yet.
No, she had. She got one for Kiss Spider Woman and
Okay, good. I'm glad she got one.
But yeah, she's got plenty.
Okay.
she's got hers. But yeah, sometimes there's that. But I mean, it's not evil. It's just when you're like, I think in your year, for example, for Caroline, I think ultimately, you know, I wrote a cover story on this at that time. You shouldn't have. Actors should not read. I don't think actors should read assessments of them while they're doing a show. I think it's dangerous.
Yeah, because those words stay in your mind. Then you're like, can I achieve those words again?
Yeah, I fully understand when actors don't. But I wrote a story that year about what a great race it was for Best Actress in a Musical.
Oh, it was killer.
And I think that ultimately what it came down to there is, one, they were giving it to Avenue Q and they wanted to give something to Wicked. So that helped Adina. And two, you and Donna and Kristen had all won Tony Awards already. And Adina had not. So if it comes down to that, if it comes down to, well, there are four women giving these amazing performances, and one of them doesn't have a Tony yet.
And Audra was in that category, wasn't she?
No, it was Stephanie DiBruzzo.
Oh, Stephanie DiBruzzo, that's right.
And Stephanie was lovely in that show, but it wasn't a performance on the same plane.
Right.
I mean, it demanded a lot less.
But Wicked is a brand. I mean, it's the Wizard of Oz.
But also, I think that the four that I mentioned, this is no diss on Stephanie. She was very good in Avenue Q, but she was behind a puppet most of the time. It wasn't that kind of performance.
Right.
The other four were giving really distinctive, memorable, personal performance.
And the awards split between people that year. You know, didn't Donna get one of them? And like they really split.
Well, yeah, but again, when it came down to, so there are those factors. I think that Adina won partly because people wanted to give something to Wicked and partly because she was the one who hadn't won.
And she was going to become a huge brand. I mean, she's like the highest paid cabaret artist worldwide.
Well, she's very talented and distinctive, and she contributed a great deal to that show.
Absolutely.
This is the value. I think that's a great example. Wicked is a good example of how having original stars with strong personal identities as performers can really help a show in the long term, even if it's going to be a long running show in which those people will be replaced many times over. The stamp that Kristen and Adina put on those roles is still on those roles. And that helps define those roles for performers who step into it in the future.
Mm-hmm. Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUFSmusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. based on S.E. Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that, with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com.
So that's, you know, I know that nowadays a lot of when you have that kind of show and you're really selling the logo, you don't want to pin too much on the star, because then if the star leaves,
right, exactly,
you know, blah blah blah. That happened with The Producers, for example,
right?
But still having a strong original star, an original star with a strong personality,
a one-off,
yeah. Because no one's going to be exactly them anymore, but there will be residual elements of their performance.
Though I have to say that I feel like too many musicals have been writing the songs to have that ba-da-da-da at the end of them, and I can't stand it. But like, people like are composing that now, and it's maddening.
Well,
to me.
And it's also brutal on women's bodies.
Yeah,
I mean, the voices are not. That's not sustainable 8 times a week.
Right, and it's not pretty either.
And it doesn't. It ends up getting unpretty, yeah. And then you have all these mean pirate videos of people missing those notes.
Yes.
And of course they're going to miss those notes sometimes, because those notes are set impossibly high.
Yes.
And it goes back to, I mean, it started earlier. It's a different sound. So it starts when you have people just sort of, I guess I would probably put the first one I can really think of like that is Melba Moore doing those crazy high parts in Hair and then in Pearly. You know,
Well, Loretta Devine said that they purposely sang everything high in Dreamgirls so they couldn't get fired and couldn't be replaceable.
Yeah, so you had Melba Moore, and then you started having things that were set mm-hmm. in that place where people had to do this mixed belt thing.
Yeah.
And
Patti LuPone seems to effortlessly do.
Patti LuPone did in Evita.
Forever.
And, right. But Patti LuPone is...
A war horse.
And they put other people in that position, and it will be... And then they did it in Dreamgirls, and then everyone... does it, and now it's just written for that, because all the pop divas do it, but they have to do it once in a studio, you know, right. You have to do it 8 times a week in real
right.
time, you know, it's monstrous. But now all the girls coming up,
I
they,
know
they have to sing that way,
and I just don't even like the way it sounds. I don't even want to hear it.
Sometimes it can be exciting.
Give me a time it was exciting recently.
I saw the concert version of Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat that they did a few weeks ago, and boy, they split up the narrator role between three awfully good singers.
Really?
Yeah. And
they were just killing it. It was like vocal gymnastics.
Yeah, because, and also there are three of them, so they didn't have to do, you know, they could just pull it out. And it was only, because the narrator, there's no content, so they could just be show-offy. And
ooh,
boy, were they show-offy.
That sounds exciting.
It was exciting.
Yeah,
because you're just
yeah.
watching people do flips. Yeah.
Right, but you can't do that 8 shows a week.
No, absolutely not.
Right.
Impossible. Although these women... two women and a guy. It was Alex Newell and it was also Jessica Vosk and Eden Espinoza. And they are very seasoned at doing that particular thing.
Mm-hmm.
But Jessica got one of the biggest applause points in the night for this, the second act opener to the Pharaoh's Dream thing, where which is not
showy.
An obvious show-off song, but... And it wasn't even the highest. It was just how full and how beautiful the voice sounded.
Mm.
So, you know.
Now, you do dance too, right?
I don't really do
oh,
dance.
Oh, so you didn't see Black, White, and Gray?
I did not. I see some dance sometimes, and I do all the dance listings.
Got it.
But I don't review dance. We've never reviewed dance in the magazine, even when we had Gia Corliss, who's at the Times now, used to be our dance editor at Time Out. But she never reviewed dance, in part because the shows never last long enough. And so our magazine is really built around telling you what you should be doing next week, not about what you should have seen last
so
week.
So does it have to run more than 1 week?
Yeah, basically.
It has to run more than 1 week or forget times
yeah,
out.
Yeah, we don't review music shows either for that reason, because it's we would just be telling people what they should already have seen, and that's not helpful to them. We can see these shows, and then in the future we can write previews of them.
Got it.
But we can't review a show that is already done.
Got it.
So dance. Dance was never on that model, and it isn't still. I like to see dance shows. I'm not. as experienced at it. So I wouldn't want to write about it anyway. I trust my own expertise on that. I can write about musical theater dancing. I do know about that, but I don't want to, you know, I don't want to pretend that I'm good enough as a balletomane to.
Now I'm going to tangent you
yeah.
back to constitutional language. It's kind of something that I'm interested in.
I didn't pursue it, so I can't tell you anything about it.
Are you joking?
No, I'm not joking. I was working at the time. There's this wonderful professor at Harvard. I think she's still there, named Elaine Scarry. And she was very interested in government, and she would have been the one I was working on there. I ended up doing other coursework with her, and she wrote an amazing book on pain, which I recommend to people. It's called The Body in Pain. But I didn't end up going down that route, so I don't.
Don't know. I mean, it sounds like it's something that's of interest to you. So it's like, you know, this constitutional convention. I mean, everybody's saying we can't have a constitutional convention, but then we have the fact that in 15 years, the majority of Americans will live in the South, and you will still have the Senate as it is, with, you know, it's currently, you know, leaning a certain way, mm-hmm. and the only way to alter that is with a constitutional convention that would change the balance of powers of the Senate, which was really based on slave-holding states.
Right.
So, like, you know, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, it's complicated. I think
everything
is. No, that's a different question, because I think that what I was talking about before was really much more of an academic thing. It was be studying the language and the way that these things are written, not the content, which is what
got
this
it.
Was supposed to be about.
Got it, got it.
You
mean what words meant
yes,
at the time?
Right, and how they are used to shape concepts. But in this case, I think the challenges of a constitutional convention are obviously that in order to make constitutional change, you have to have massive majorities. And a lot of these places that would have to vote for it have a vested interest in the existing system. And so mm-hmm. getting above that threshold is just, on a practical level, extremely difficult. And so it's nice to dream about that, but on a practical basis, these small states that have this disproportionate power are not going to be eager to give that up.
Correct.
And unfortunately, the system as it is requires them to do that. And so that is going to be a major structural impediment. What we can do and hope for is we can hope that there are long enough demographic and cultural shifts in some of these places that are currently considered strongly red, that these will be more in play than we think. For example, Texas is changing. Georgia is changing.
Yeah, because all these people are moving to the South.
Yeah.
But the Senate's going to still be the Senate.
Well, right.
We're going to have this huge influx of population in the South that are people who are blue, which is going to flip. The South is going to flip blue.
But some of it. Not Mississippi.
Alabama and Mississippi.
Right. But Georgia, yes. And Texas, possibly, like those places, and those are big prizes in terms of the Electoral College. They're very vote rich places. And ultimately, if those places, we win those places and we continue not to win North and South Dakota, then that's good for us. It'll be hard in the Senate, but it'll be fine for us in the Electoral College. I think that that's what we can hope for. Meanwhile, we need to make sure that we present a consolidated front.
And that we aren't able to do
that. We have a hard time doing that because a lot of the insurgent part of our side is training a lot of its fire on other people on our side. Because they know they can't fire on the other side. The other side doesn't care, isn't listening. You know? So
and there's fire. We gotta get the fire's gotta go somewhere.
The fire has to go somewhere. And they believe or they minimize the difference, in my opinion. They understate the differences that are major differences between even the people they dismiss as centrists and corporatists, neoliberals on our side. There is an enormous gulf between that and the current administration. There just is. And that gulf is unfortunately minimized in some of the rhetoric. And then that becomes dangerous in the long term because those people, when their candidate does not get the nomination, feel disenfranchised, feel disillusioned, feel cynical, do not show up to vote. And then our side loses in crucial, tight places where we could really use their support. And so what we need to do is remember, take a long view, step back and remember who our allies are.
Yeah, that's just not the nature. I mean, you know, I made a feature film this year. It's a sociopolitical horror film called Red Pill. Hmm. And it's essentially about that. It's about how one side, you know, they think they're the smartest. They think they're the they've got the ideas, but they can't consolidate to be a force. Mm-hmm. And the other side is like, you know, we don't agree about a lot of stuff, but we agree that they're bad.
The other side has easier messaging.
And so it allows them to be far more effective and focused.
It appeals to people. And this is one of the things, it's a paradox. Because I think one of the things that Hillary Clinton ran into trouble with in 2016 is people thought that she was being dishonest. I think the opposite was true. I think that her tendency was to explain too much, to get into too much nuance and detail. And she would keep talking and she would qualify her opinions and she would keep it. And that impulse read the opposite ways because people think, she's trying to be evasive. She's saying too much. You know, like, so when you don't have a clear message, people think that you're talking around something. In fact, she was talking very much more specifically about
it. And giving you details that most people, that's details. Too much work. Right. Just can't you say it plain?
Right.
Just say it plain.
And then people have, you know, we have a natural anti-intellectual sort of, not I won't say natural, we have a general anti-intellectual bent in the country.
And in the world.
In the world. And when you hear someone talking too much, there's a way in which that sounds like they're trying to talk around it. They're trying to trick you.
But we also can't forget about the fact that we are also in the era where, you know, surveillance capitalism and Google and Facebook, you know, targeting people with very specific messaging that's going to control how they see things.
For sure.
You know, we don't even know what people are being what people are seeing. Like you and I, we get a different feed.
Right. and it's worse than that because the feed that we get is specifically designed to reinforce what we already think.
And to keep us online.
And to keep us there.
Keep us irritated and online.
And to keep us thinking, to keep telling us what we already know. Or what we think we know.
Or whatever's going to keep us irritated enough that we stay online and repost and keep looking and keep reposting.
And retreat farther and farther into our own bubble worlds. And then ever so often that bubble will burst and we'll be so surprised. We'll say, oh my God, everyone that I know loves Elizabeth Warren. You know?
Who just dropped out on this day that we are recording.
Right. You know, I mean, it can be really, and this is one. This is one thing that I think we really got into trouble with the last time around, which is that in real life, Hillary Clinton basically cinched the nomination on Super Tuesday in the last primary. Mathematically, there was no chance that Sanders was ever going to be the nominee. But the media continued, because they have to make a story out of it for another 5 months, they continued to play it like it was a real horse race. Mm. And the Sanders people and the Sanders camp continued to run as though it were, and it was, theoretically it could have been a miracle and he could have won 80% of the vote in the remaining states and that would have divided enough for him to get a majority of the delegates, but it was not, everyone in the real world knew that that wasn't going to happen, except the Sanders side in that election kept the illusion alive, and there were all these articles that were written in the Sanders press, and they would all just share them with each other on Facebook, and it would be like, he's still going to win. He still has a chance. Here's how. And so when it didn't happen, because that's all they had been reading, there was a deep sense of disappointment, disillusionment, cynicism, surprise.
And that's from your feed. Now, let me tell you from my feed. My sense of what happened that time was that Sanders and 45 were talking the same talk. Mm. Whether that talk was sincere or not, they were talking the same talk.
Populous.
And so they were appealing to a populace. Mm-hmm. And I think people were ignoring those people, that people had a strong sway, and they were ignoring the fact that those people were looking for someone, and that if Sanders wasn't the nominee, they were going to go the way they went. And so for me, from my perspective, I know people say he pushed her to change her views, but I really was disappointed that he didn't take it all the way to the convention and just force it even more. That was my disappointment. And first of all, I knew neither of them were going to win. I was clear that neither of them were going to win, but I felt he should have pushed it even further, and that she was believing her own hype, not going to certain states. Like, it was like, no, you do not, you're not understanding this populist thing that the current president was appealing to and that was speaking to the same audience that he was there, and they were taken for granted.
It's very easy in retrospect. I think a lot of people did expect Clinton to win. Most people did expect Clinton to win.
Yeah, I wasn't one of those people.
No, I'll tell you, no. I will say, I think in a way, maybe the generalized expectation that Clinton was certainly going to win is what cost Clinton, is the biggest factor. Well, because it depressed voting, and also it changed people's decision making. Like, Comey I really don't think would have released that letter
if he didn't think she was going to win.
Had he not thought that she was going to win. I think that he didn't want everyone knew she was going to win anyway, and he didn't want afterwards for people to say, you suppressed this letter. And the media, everyone thought that she was going to win anyway, so they might as well hit the email thing. And Sanders people were like, she's going to win anyway, we might as well push our position as far as we can. Everyone thought that she was going to win. And she thought that she was going
to
win.
There was no way she was ever going to win, because women are more hated in this country than black people. Black people, you know, we got a black president before we got a woman. We're still not ready for a woman president because women hate women. We are not ready for a woman. I was clear there was no way a woman was going to win. And people looked at me with contempt like I had two heads. It was like, no, there's too much misogyny in America.
I think that's sadly true. But I will say this, and this is a bit, everyone I knew thought that Clinton was going to win.
You know me.
Well, no, I mean, almost
your everyone, circle.
Almost everyone I know.
I had no circle because I didn't believe it.
I will say this. I did not, on the day of the election, I did not think that Clinton was going to win. And I'll tell you when.
You knew.
This is a larger, all right, let's see if I can articulate this right. The moment that I knew, or in my heart, like I still thought, well, we have a chance, and we did have a chance, you know. But the moment that in my heart, my secret heart, I knew that we were not going to win, was the night before the election, because I was in bed, and here I found myself gloating in advance about the election. Ooh. I was fantasizing about rubbing it in to all those stupid, terrible people who supported Donald Trump, and what fools they were going to look like, and how disastrous it was going to be for the Republicans, and how satisfying it would be to say, look, you idiots, look what just happened. America won. And I felt that hatred in my heart. And I knew at that moment, we can't win. Because I'm a good barometer of... That's why I guess Oscars well. I'm a good barometer of what people are feeling. There was a lot of that. There was a lot of that I will drink your tears feeling going around on our side. And the other side really doesn't like that. Mm. And you're never going to win with that kind of hatred. You're not. Because they sense that. No one likes being thought of as an idiot. No one likes being dismissed. No one likes... being condescended to. And our side was doing a lot of that. And we still are. We have to find ways, as hard as it is, because people who support that man are so, it takes so much for me not to be angry with them all the time. Because to me, it seems so obvious. But a lot of people are not paying this much attention, or the media that they're getting is telling them a very different story. Mm-hmm. And they're trying to do the best they can. I mean, there's some of them who really are just terrible people, of course, but many of them are not. Many of them, you know, are responding to elements of his message that that resonate with them. And we have to reach those people. We have to appeal to those people. We have to forgive those people for their mistakes. We have to allow them. We have to give them the space and the face to walk it back. If someone makes a mistake and then realizes or comes to a different understanding, we have to create an open space to welcome them and not just say, you are forever damned for your mistake or for your bad way of thinking that you used to have. I think very differently today than I did when I was a child. I know that I think very differently today in some ways than I did 10 years ago. things evolve, conversations evolve, our understandings evolve. And I think we need to have a more loving understanding of that. I'm not saying we shouldn't fight. I'm saying we have to fight in a more loving way.
And I'm going to play devil's advocate as we wrap up right now and say that it's so much deeper than that. There's so many more people who are disenfranchised, whose lives are not in any way altered by who is in the White House, who are struggling and who are just like, it can't
lives
get
are
any worse.
Altered.
It's not altered.
Don't know it.
I'm going to say their lives aren't altered. And it's like, you know what? Now you get to feel a little bit of what I'm feeling. I don't say this lightly, but I see not only another 8 years, but I think the next question will be, when are the term limits ended and how many more years will we have the current administration? Thank you, Adam Feldman, for having this conversation
with me.
Thank you
for
having me. We'll have to do this off platform. I enjoy you. You're smart. I don't meet very many smart people that I can actually talk with. You are listening to Tanya Pinkins on You Can't Say That. Thanks for listening to You Can't Say That, the show where you can. I'm Tanya Pinkins. This is part of the Broadway Podcast Network, produced by Dori Berenstein and Alan Seals, edited by Derek Gunther, music by Anthony Norman, available wherever you get your podcast. And visit me on Twitter and Facebook and Instagram, and let me know what you'd like to hear me talk about. For more information, visit bpn.fm/YCST.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but
yeah.
Not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.